Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will and Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey and Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, former advisor to Marco Rubio is criticizing Republicans for allowing a conservative podcaster. He's had other jobs, but that one's the one that's been featured right now, to become the FBI deputy director. And what do you know? We have that former advisor with us. Greg Nunziata is executive director of the Society for the Rule of Law. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
As Ryan mentioned, we'll be talking about the tapping of Dan Bongino in a moment. Last month, the U.S. Senate very narrowly confirmed Kash Patel as the new FBI director. He's a former Department of Defense chief of staff and ex-federal prosecutor, as well as a historically highly vocal critic of the FBI. Tell us more first about Patel.
Sure. And in addition to having worked for Senator Rubio at an earlier stage of my career, I was chief nominations counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I'm very familiar with the confirmation process for FBI directors and others. And you know, frankly, one of the top reasons we have Senate confirmation is to prevent a president from appointing somebody who is chiefly distinguished by personal loyalty to important government jobs. It's supposed to act as a filter to make sure, yes, the president gets his choice, but somebody who has the qualifications and the character necessary for the job in question. And I think Mr. Patel, Kash Patel, is precisely who you wouldn't want in this position. And I was personally surprised and a bit disappointed that he was confirmed and that he lost two Republican votes, but got confirmed with 51 Senate votes. As you said, he's a lawyer. He does have a background as a federal prosecutor, I think just for 2 or 3 years. Most of his litigation experience was as a public defender in Miami. But he really rose to prominence not on the strength of his legal background, but as a partisan operative. He came to Washington and worked first in the House of Representatives, kind of helping Republicans push back against and frustrate the various investigations into President Trump during his first term. Then he joined the administration and served a number of roles there. And during the first Trump term, President Trump suggested putting Mr. Patel at the head of the FBI or the CIA and got lots of pushback from the professional folks in his own administration, in particular Attorney General Bill Barr, who said that that would happen over his dead body because Mr. Patel was so ill-suited for a job like this. Since the administration, he's displayed his unsuitability even further. You know, over the last 4 years, he really became a big personality in kind of the MAGA world. He appeared on a lot of podcasts. He wrote a children's book in which President Trump is portrayed as the king of this realm who's unjustly persecuted. He spoke a lot about the January 6th defendants, talking about them as political prisoners and talking about the FBI as some sort of deep state conspiracy. Maybe most concerning to a lot of observers was, you know, he wrote a book called Government Gangsters, where he rails against what he calls the deep state and identified dozens of people by name. He spoke openly to podcasters and others about if President Trump gets back into power, these are the kinds of folks that the government ought to go after. So it's just very concerning from in a job like this. You want somebody who appears committed to the equal application of the law, not to an agenda, certainly not to an enemies list. And so his selection and his confirmation, I think, raised a lot of alarm bells here in town.
Greg, he and also the new deputy FBI director, Dan Bongino, as Tina mentioned, he also has, you know, a very colorful history. He's former Trump, former Fox, I'm sorry, former newscaster, also podcaster, pro-Trump influencer. Surprised a lot of people that he's now number two. He was a former U.S. Secret Service agent, but traditionally the rank of the deputy FBI director comes from a career veteran FBI agent. So that raised a lot of eyebrows too. But listen, isn't the bottom line from the Trump perspective the fact that he won? He was not shy about associating with these people and promising that he would shake things up. And this is in line with what he said he would do. And he did it. He's got a lot of political capital. So what's the problem with a president who ran on something actually doing it?
Well, you know, I think I'd say, a few things. You're right that the choice of Bongino shocked a lot of folks. That position has historically... Patel is an unconventional choice to start with to lead the agency. The number two spot has always really, in living memory anyway, been an experienced FBI agent. There's the expectation that the administration would choose somebody like that, would put some ballast on Patel and help inform his ability to run the agency. I mean, look, this agency has thousands and thousands of employees. So even if you want some disruption, you would also ideally want somebody with a deep knowledge of how the place works, its ethos, at that person's side. So choosing Bongino kind of doubled down on what I thought was a bad choice to start with. And look, yes, the president has the ability to hire who he wants. I think the Senate and Congress and even Trump supporters should want him to pick people who are most suited for the job. Patel and Bongino both say they're going to root out bias in the FBI. But people who've spent the last 10 years being aggressive partisan actors, not to mention conspiracy theorists, hardly seem like the right people to restore the FBI to the most neutral footing possible. You simply don't correct for bias in an organization by introducing more bias in the other direction. So, I mean, I'm not here to say that the FBI couldn't use some disruption and that it hasn't made mistakes over its history, but it is a very for all its problems, it is a highly capable professional agency that ought to be reformed, shook up a bit, but not hollowed out. And putting in the people in the top two positions like this is just bound to have a really demoralizing effect on the agency. It's bound to make it harder to recruit the kind of law enforcement professionals you want, to encourage early retirements. And even as you've seen, Patel in his early days has, this administration, including with Patel coming over there, have pushed out some of the most senior agents that we have here in the Washington headquarters and around the country.
So, Greg, we've seen a lot of sweeping changes since Trump took office a few weeks ago. Many of these changes have sparked debate over the rule of law and the limits of executive power. Do you care to comment on that as a rule of law expert?
Yeah, it's there are very, very many changes. It seems like there are new ones every day and new lawsuits every day challenging some of these. And it can be hard to get a handle on all of them. I would try to... at least with respect to executive power, assertions of executive power, I would try to put them in two buckets. One is the president's claimed authority over the executive branch, including independent agencies. So he's fired a lot of people that traditionally are not fired by new presidents or that have some statutory protection and are supposed to be fired except for cause. Or something like this. So this is the first column. This is the president's command over the government, over the executive functions of government. The second bucket is what power he asserts vis-a-vis the other two branches, so Congress and the judiciary. In the first category, I think there are lots of different views on what is legal and what is illegal. I think that the president may win a lot of those court challenges on his ability to remove personnel, even from independent agencies. However, just because something is legal doesn't mean it's wise. And I think a lot of these decisions taken together do remove sort of the internal brakes on the executive branch, internal brakes that are designed to make sure the president and the government go by the books. You know, the inspectors general, senior lawyers in the Department of Defense, these are folks who are there to make sure that the president and his subordinates make a good faith effort to follow the law. And it's concerning that he seems to be rooting those folks out and replacing them with loyalists. Everybody in our government in the executive branch has to follow the lawful directives of the president, but not unlawful ones, right? They their highest duty is to the law and the Constitution. And it's concerning that he's seems to be weeding out those who are best suited to ensure that happens. The second column, I think, what power the president may claim against the other two branches is more profoundly concerning. Our founding fathers, their chief design in the Constitution to protect our liberties and to protect our democracy were checks and balances. We all learned about it in middle school. Congress and the judiciary have powers to check the presidency. And in a raft of areas, from spending to policymaking, it appears that the president wants to cut Congress out of governing. And there have been increasing sounds from him and his allies about the possibility that he might disregard a court order, which would really, really be a profound challenge to our constitutional system. So, I think the first one, lots of mess. He may win some cases, he may lose some cases. All of it taken together is concerning. But that second bucket about the balance of powers and checks and balances, to me, is potentially the constitutional crisis that people talk about. Is what could be kind of the most direct challenge to our system, our constitutional system, and our rule of law.
Greg, excuse me. Last question. We got about 2 minutes. You mentioned concerning. You mentioned crisis in your last answer. Those words aren't strong enough to describe the absolute horror show that we all witnessed in the Oval Office on Friday of last week when Ukrainian President Zelensky embarrassingly was dressed down by not just the president, but by the vice president. You wrote an excellent piece in the Dispatch about it. And you said that Zelensky failed to appreciate that our president is a moronic narcissist and our vice president is a disingenuous climber. Don't beat around the bush, Greg. Tell us what you really feel. I want to get your opinion on what that says about the rule of law, not just domestically, but of course, very importantly, about our role in international relations. And we would be remiss if we didn't ask you about the role of your former boss in that exchange while he was sitting on the couch. I think best depicted on SNL accurately is just sitting there with a horrified look on his face, but doing nothing, and then showed up on the Sunday shows after defending Trump. So I know that's a lot, but give us your perspective on those two issues.
Sure. Well, a lot to say. I mean, yes, I thought it was a disgraceful showing. And we have, what I wrote about it was a bit tongue in cheek in responding to some of the defenses of what the president did and what the vice president did, saying, oh, this is all Zelensky's fault. He should have understood that these two men are who they are and therefore not defended the honor and integrity of his country, which was, I thought, kind of absurd. I mean, the president's behavior and the vice president's behavior, I think, regardless of what you think the right policy is on Ukraine, was despicable. It lowers our standing in the world, makes our allies all around the globe doubt our sincerity about committing, about honoring our commitments to our allies and to global security. So that's alarming. Look, the international order is sloppier than the domestic one. You know, we don't have international law is not quite the same thing as domestic law, but we do have a rules-based international order, one that was hard fought and hard won after just devastating wars in the last century. And the cavalierness with which the president seems poised to throw away our allies, our alliances, and throw away this structure that has helped maintain peace and promote prosperity in a very dangerous world. I just think it's really, really reckless. I mean, this is, talk about, again, status quo shouldn't be maintained just for the status quo, but they also should be disrupted with some prudence and judgment. And I don't see that happening here. You know, one thing to keep an eye on, of course, is what is going to happen with the NATO alliance. And speaking about Senator Rubio, when he was still a senator, he did work hard in an effort to change the law to clarify that the president cannot withdraw from NATO without the support of Congress. And you know, I hope that Senator Rubio will continue to make a case, at least internally in the administration, for honoring our alliances and championing human rights and democracy abroad.
We're going to have to leave it there. Greg Nunziata, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. The U.S. Supreme Court this week dismissed an Oklahoma death row inmate's conviction over evidence it says was withheld during the murder trial. But Elizabeth Semmel, the Chancellor's Clinical Professor of Law and co-director of the Death Penalty Clinic at UC Berkeley, says don't read too much into that decision. Professor, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
You know, Professor, this was a 5-3 decision. Richard Glossop, the majority decision was authored by Justice Sotomayor. Does this mean that the Supreme Court has become less conservative, particularly with regards to the death penalty?
I think it would be a reach to make that assertion or make that statement. I think what we can take from the opinion is that under the specific facts of this case, five justices found that the state had violated long established, clearly established decisions regarding prosecutors' obligations under the Constitution, in particular, their duty not to present false testimony and to correct it if that occurs. And the same is true for the state's withholding and destroying of evidence that violated the Constitution and undermined confidence in the guilty verdict. This, I would say, is a conservative decision in the traditional small c sense of the word. So a majority of the court here adhered to a 1959 precedent that due process is violated when prosecutors' actions deprive a jury of the ability to decide the case on the evidence. And that deprivation, in other words, that conduct by prosecutors made a difference or likely made a difference in the outcome. This is, you know, this is a precedential decision. This is following well-established precedent.
Well, Professor, can we drill down a little bit more about the particular facts of this case, which make it so unique that we are not really thinking that this is a dramatic shift in how the Supreme Court looks at death penalty cases?
Sure. What I think when we use the word, there is nothing unique about prosecutors withholding evidence. I mean, sadly, there's nothing unique about withholding evidence. There's nothing unique about prosecutors failing to correct false testimony. In some cases, it's been described as an epidemic, and whether one agrees with that characterization or not, that isn't what unique. What is common, however, or more commonplace, is that when the allegation is made that this has occurred, prosecutors vigorously fight the claim that they've either violated the law or that what they did actually made a difference in the outcome. So while not unique, it is highly unusual for the state to do what is called confessing error. In other words, to acknowledge here, as the Attorney General of Oklahoma did, that it made an error, that it failed to correct false testimony, and actually file a brief in the Supreme Court, where the Attorney General is represented by counsel, asking the court to reverse because the false testimony had undermined the credibility of the state's key witness. So that is not, maybe not unique, but certainly highly unusual. Again, I don't think it portends a shift in the court. What I do hope is that in the face of an administration under Donald Trump that has shown disregard for the rule of law thus far, that it will reinforce the determination on the part of a majority of the court to adhere to the rule of law.
Speaking of that, you know, the Oklahoma Attorney General is Republican. So it is good to see, perhaps, for those of us who agree with your feeling that the rule of law seems to be an afterthought frequently, that even though this would be adverse to his constituency, he did follow, as you mentioned, well-established precedent. He is considering on behalf of the state whether to try Glossop now for the third time. What do you think they will do? Certainly, there's a lot of pressure, and we've heard a lot of quotes from the family of the victims to prosecute him again and finally get it right. And what do you think they'll do differently, if anything, to you know, sustain a conviction this time?
Well, I would neither speculate. I can't, and I wouldn't speculate about what a prosecutor will do. I would say that there are a couple of critical issues, and they're intertwined. And I think one at least has been discussed very publicly by Mr. Drummond, and that is whether or not, when there's a reversal of a conviction, as there was here, or reversal of a death sentence, especially decades after the conviction or the judgment, the question a prosecutor always has to ask is, what is provable based on the evidence that exists today? So that means, and I believe Mr. Drummond has been plain about this, whether he has to decide whether the evidence supports a death sentence, supports a sentence of life without parole, for example, whether it actually supports a conviction on a lesser offense, an attempt to resolve the case, if that can be done, or to dismiss. He said publicly that under today's standards, it would be difficult, I think those were his words, to retry the case. Here, as we've alluded to at least, the case hinges on the testimony of the state's witness, the key witness, Mr. Sneed, and it was Mr. Sneed's false testimony at trial that led to this reversal, evidence the state failed to correct. So in a new trial, a number of decades later, the prosecutor not only has to contend with whatever may have been destroyed, dissipated, be unavailable, but also these egregious errors that are likely to be known to the jury. So it puts the prosecutor in a very different position, and it ought to, than he was when the case was originally tried. Secondly, is the related issue, which I think ought to weigh very heavily on the state attorney and the attorney general, certainly as to the death penalty, and that is, what are the consequences when the state, by its own admissions, has violated the Constitution? Are there consequences that have to be paid when this serious deprivation of constitutional rights occurs? Should the state be permitted to again seek the death penalty? And I think an appropriate decision for this prosecutor in this situation, at minimum, is that he should not be able to seek the death penalty again. And the other questions, I think, are maybe more dependent on what he, you know, his assessment of the evidence, which, at least to my my eye, looks very problematically thin.
So, Professor, to your point about just questioning the death penalty generally, Oklahoma had set 9 execution dates for Glossop, including one where he didn't die because there was a drug mix-up. What does this say about the death penalty generally?
Well, it's interesting you asked what it says about the death penalty, not just what does it say about methods of execution. And I think the question you asked is the important one. It's also important that this isn't Mr. Glossop's first time before the U.S. Supreme Court. He was there in a case, Glossop versus Gross, in 2015, that had very specifically to do with the method of execution Oklahoma was proposing to use. And in that case, Justice Breyer, then on the court, dissented, and he wrote that the court really ought to, rather than, I think his language was, patching up the death penalty clinic's legal wounds one at a time, the court ought to address very squarely whether under the Constitution the death penalty death penalty's infirmities could be healed. Now, I don't think this is a court, the current court under Donald Trump, that would, should, or could address those questions fairly. But it can be said that Mr. Glossop is essentially a poster for the failings of the death penalty, his case. And that and in Glossop in 2015, Justice Breyer literally went through a list of all of those failings that applied to Mr. Glossop as well. The risk of executing innocent people, which Mr. Glossop certainly exemplifies. The fact that the number was different in 2015, but today we're at over 200 death row exonerations. Studies showing that the way the death penalty ought to apply, which is based, for example, on culpability, an individual's culpability, is not how it often applies, which is based on race and geography, for example. And then the tension between finality, in other words, people's desire to have it over, and the desire to do it correctly, that is reliability, and how this is oftentimes an irreconcilable tension, because the quicker we proceed, the more often we make mistakes. Those are just a few of the things he surfaced that I think the Glossop case in many ways embodies.
Professor, last night in his first State of the Union of his second term as president, Donald Trump said that he signed an executive order requiring a mandatory death penalty for anyone who murders a police officer. What are your thoughts?
Well, I thought the announcement was squarely in line with Donald Trump's now familiar assertion that he is the law. You know, as I would observe, at least since taking office, he's acted as if the United States is an autocracy and not a democratic republic governed by three branches of government. It reminded me very much of the Queen of Hearts statement in Alice in Wonderland, you know, off with their heads. It reflected his ignorance of how laws are made by state legislatures and Congress, not by the executive, how courts determine whether laws are constitutional or not, not the executive. It reflected his ignorance of the fact that Congress makes laws governing the federal system. So even if Congress passed a law, it would affect the federal system. It wouldn't affect the 50 states. And ultimately that courts, the highest courts in the state, the U.S. Supreme Court, say what the law is, not Donald Trump. So I think perhaps most importantly, let me just add that back in 1976, the United States Supreme Court in two cases out of Louisiana and North Carolina said a mandatory death penalty violates the Eighth Amendment. And importantly, when the court decided those two cases, it pointed out that this prohibition against a mandatory death penalty, the notion that individual culpability is what is the basis of a death penalty decision, not just the crime someone commits, is an idea that went back another century. So it wasn't new when the court decided it definitively in 1976, and the idea is not new. So I would say again, the notion that the death penalty cannot be mandatory is a conservative notion.
I'm shocked to hear you say that President Trump, constitutional expert that he is and lover of legal precedent, is unaware of death penalty precedent.
Oh, yeah. I know. It was hard for me to get the words out, but I managed.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us. I'm looking right now. I just opened up your the publication, Guess Who's Coming to Jury Duty? How the Failure to Collect Juror Demographic Data Contributes to Whitewashing the Jury Box. It's just 83 pages. I'm going to hit that on my train ride home, I think.
Go for it. Well, go for the illustrations, the visuals.
I like them. It's great illustrations. Did you do them yourself?
No, we have a wonderful design team of designers in the communications department at the law school who help make, you know, the inscrutable or the obtuse very, very clear.
Well, I have a feeling a lot of people want to thumb through this. It looks like it's very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
This is my pleasure.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Erin Murphy is a Norman Dorson Professor of Civil Liberties at NYU. She's also an internationally recognized expert in forensic DNA typing and the author of Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA, and
She uses Legally Blonde to teach real life legal tactics, and she'll be talking about that with us today. Thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
So, Professor, as Ryan profiled, you use Legally Blonde, the very well-known Reese Witherspoon movie from 20-some years ago, where she plays a law student named Elle Woods. You use that as part of your teachings. There were a number of memorable scenes in the movie, both classroom scenes as well as in court. As a law school professor, how realistic do you find this movie to be? And how often do you and maybe some of your colleagues look to shows and movies as a teaching tool?
So there's parts of the trial scenes that are quite realistic. And that's one of the reasons I use that clip. I will say I use a lot of clips in my teaching. I use clips from contemporary things like The Bachelor TV show or you know, movies that have been come out recently. I also use a lot of historical stuff. So I'll use clips from It's a Wonderful Life or I'm trying to think of other examples, Star Trek, you know, the original Star Trek movies. So I try to bring evidence to life in the classroom by using material that both is accessible to students because they watch these shows and they kind of know the characters, or just puts a scenario in their head that can be much more realistic and kind of enlivened than like a dead, you know, paragraph on a page. I will say there, you know, not all films are created equal. I tell my students that My Cousin Vinny, an old classic, is an authorized study tool for evidence. They do a great job. There is a show that was on TV for a while called The Good Wife that by and large did a lot of good courtroom scenes as well. But I would not recommend Law and Order. A little bit too dramatic or the drama maybe gets to override the evidence rules. And there's other shows, of course, where the drama is really driving as opposed to the actual rules of law.
So I have to just ask you real quick before we pivot to impeachment. What do you think of LA Law? I mean, that was actually a show that influenced me and my career decision to go to law school. I'm just curious what you think of LA Law.
You know, I honestly haven't revisited LA Law. I'm going to have to do that to see how the actual law. I watched it faithfully as a young person. It probably is one of the things in my you know, journey to law as well. But I haven't like thought of the scenes there from a professor point of view, as opposed to just a, you know, someone being entertained.
Okay, well, you may want to check it out. My husband and I actually watched the whole series straight through about a year ago, and it's remarkable how it stood the test of time, given that it started like 40 years ago. So let me know what you think. So pivoting back for a moment to Legally Blonde, a key trial technique that was showcased in the movie is something you know a lot about, which is evidence and impeachment, in particular, impeachment of a witness. What are the different types of impeachment? And explain for our listeners a little bit more about how it was used in that final courtroom scene in the movie.
Sure. So first, just to back up, impeachment is the idea that you're trying to discredit the witness in some way. And most people think of it as like that you're lying. But of course, you can discredit witnesses without even suggesting they're lying intentionally. They might be innocently mixed up. They might have forgotten a detail that's important. So there are five classic forms of impeachment. One is called character for truthfulness. It's just the idea that someone's a liar generally. So that one you are saying they are not telling the truth, as opposed to a particular way you can point to the lie in this case. Another, you know, common one is what's called prior inconsistent statement. That's the idea that someone said something different in the past than they're saying right now, maybe because they're lying, but maybe just because they are inconsistently remembering. And that is the reason they shouldn't be believed. One's bias, which everyone knows you have a horse in this race, you know, that's your boyfriend, sister, son, whatever. And one is called capacity. That's just the idea that you couldn't have seen what you thought you saw. Again, maybe because you're not telling the truth, but maybe also just because you didn't have your glasses on or, you know, you couldn't hear that far away. And then the last, which is the one that's at issue in this case or this movie, is called specific contradiction. And this can be a hard one for people to wrap their heads around, because the idea here is that other evidence in the world tells us that the witness's testimony can't be believed for some reason. So, you know, a classic might be the witness says, I was sitting in a restaurant when I saw the car accident, and you can prove the restaurant was closed that day. And you don't even have to get into like why they said they were sitting, you know, maybe they saw an accident and they just misremembered the day, or maybe they're misremembering the restaurant. So it's not your accident, it's someone else's restaurant or accident that they saw. But the point is, I could show with independent evidence, this isn't the way you say it happened. In Legally Blonde, of course, the key kind of culminating scene is where she is lying and she says she went to get a perm, and the perm, after she got the perm, she came home and she took a shower. And the reason she couldn't hear her father get shot is because she was in the shower. And Elle, being a consummate, you know, beauty fan, realizes this can't be true. And it can't be true because other evidence in the world, which is to say, you can't get a perm and take a shower or your curls will, you know, fall out. And because the girl's curls haven't fallen out, Elle knows something's not adding up here. So that is specific contradiction. The idea that you're telling me you did this sequence of events and I know from other evidence in the world that cannot be true. The thing about specific contradiction is that people, of course, contradict themselves all kinds of ways that are innocent and kind of trivial and not really relevant to the case. So, you know, you could just make a mistake about something small, like whether you went to your gym or your Pilates class, as opposed to something really important, like whether you were actually in the shower at the time you say you were in the shower. So one thing the law does is say, if it's a trivial thing, you can ask the witness about it. You can say, you know, you said you went to the gym, but isn't it true you went to Pilates studio, or didn't you skip the gym that day? But if it's just to show that they messed up like a trivial, non-really important part of the story, you can't actually introduce that exterior evidence to prove it up. It's considered kind of a waste of time to bring in the gym record or, you know, something, other evidence that shows that that's not what happened. On the other hand, if the thing that contradicts them is critical to the evidence in the case, in this case, obviously the perm would be, then you're not only allowed to ask them about it, you can actually bring in other evidence. So in the Legally Blonde example, she just gives it up. You know, she says, you didn't really get the perm, and the witness caves, you know, like all good TV, and says, you're right, you know. But if she had not done that, the law would allow her at that point to bring in the perm company to say you can't shower without your curls going, or the hairdresser to say, you know, there's no way she could have showered because her curls wouldn't have held. And that is specific contradiction and what's called the collateral evidence rule, that prevents collateral evidence but allows important evidence to come in.
Imagine, you know, it's a pretty like intuitive idea of impeachment by specific contradiction, but I would imagine the whole collateral evidence concept, that you have to be very mindful, right, as a trial lawyer about how you're going about trying to impeach your witness, right? Because I could imagine that folks would get tripped up on that if they're not super careful.
Definitely. I mean, it's a hard thing conceptually. How do you distinguish between what is, in fact, probative kind of core evidence versus collateral evidence? And then even if you can make the conceptual distinction, it's really hard to remember, oh, I'm still allowed to ask about collateral things. You know, the usual thing in evidence is you either can do it or you can't. It's either in or it's out. And in this case, the law is kind of more finely slicing the rules and saying, I can still ask all those things. I can say, you got a latte, not a cappuccino. You went to the Pilates studio, not the gym. You drove your red car, not your blue car. I can ask all those questions, but it's not until I get to a question that is independently provable, basically something that has to do with the case and the facts of the case, that I can start to introduce other evidence about it. And I think that's one of the tricks, not only in deciding, is it collateral or not, but when am I going to be allowed to actually introduce evidence versus just ask a question?
So pivoting a little bit, you're an internationally recognized expert in a lot of different areas, including forensic DNA typing. And you're the author of the 2015 book, Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA. Tell us a little bit more about your book and your research findings. And we'd love to hear from you just briefly how forensic DNA typing has evolved in the 10 years since you wrote your book.
Sure. So just in terms of the book itself, I wrote the book because DNA in the forensic capacity in the criminal legal system specifically really touches on a lot of different things. It touches on science, it touches on statistics, and it touches on social policy. It touches on questions of law, but also questions of privacy and social justice and fairness and equity. And those three camps don't always talk well to each other. And I wanted to write a book that could speak to all audiences in a language that was clear, including people who just are interested in this technology and trying to understand what its benefits, but also its risks are. So the book, you know, tries to, again, kind of address the scientific aspects, the statistical aspects, and then the legal and social aspects of the techniques. In terms of how it's changed, in some ways it's changed a lot, and in other ways it hasn't changed so much. So in the not so much category, you know, I think one of the challenges of DNA is people think of it as a kind of monolithic or, you know, as one thing. And especially if your way you've encountered DNA is through, say, medical testing. You know, you're pregnant and you get a DNA test to make sure the baby is healthy, or you have a disease predisposition and your doctor says, let's order some genetic testing. And so DNA in that capacity is super reliable. You know, it can have problems, but it's a reliable technique. It's a scientific method that's been well validated. And so the authority it carries in the medical or clinical context tends to carry over to criminal cases. And the problem with that is that DNA is reliable, but crime scene samples are not reliable. Crime scene sample, nobody, no doctor would DNA test you for a medical condition by saying, just bring in your hairbrush and we'll see what's on it, you know, or let's just grab a smear off of your light switch and see if you have this, you know, gene for breast cancer. Obviously, they do it in the clinical setting with a sterile swab that then gets a large quantity of your DNA so that if there's any issues, they can test or retest. Unfortunately, crime scenes don't come that way. They come as mixtures. They come as degraded DNA, messed up DNA. And that's where you introduce the problems that you see with DNA testing, both in the kind of way that it's weighted by juries and understood in courtrooms and by legal actors, and in the risk that you can have that people can be wrongly apprehended. The other thing I'd say about how it's really changed is obviously now it's really expansively used. Genetic genealogy, this idea that law enforcement can look not just in the databases they've created of convicted offender samples or arrested people, but in recreational databases for people who are, you know, trying to find ancestral information, am I German or am I French, or are trying to find long lost relatives, et cetera, have put their DNA voluntarily. And that's created a whole host of issues. Some people want that DNA searchable for law enforcement. Many do not. We have seen high profile examples where law enforcement doesn't really respect those people's decisions about whether they want their data available for law enforcement purposes. It's also raising all sorts of other kinds of questions about interpretation. And then the last thing I'll say is in the kind of AI or you know, machine learning space, there are now software programs that can do DNA interpretation and purport to do DNA interpretation on samples that humans could not interpret. And that just raises its other enormous suite of issues. You know, if machines are going to tell us things that humans can't explain, is that reliable evidence? How do we ensure it's safe and, you know, that lawyers have a chance to challenge it if it's not? Many of these techniques are made by for-profit companies. So obviously they have incentives to satisfy their customers. Their customers are law enforcement. So that kind of challenge, like all, you know, AI, I think across the board, is one that the criminal legal system is really grappling with today.
We got to let you get back to your class. Thanks so much for joining us. And I just want to point out, just so we all know, you don't judge a book by its hair color, right? Is that how you open up the class usually?
Obviously, all due respect to Al every time.
All right, Professor Murphy, thanks so much for coming out with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today, finally, by Jason DeMarco, head of MGA US at Players Health. Thanks for coming out with us, Jason.
No, thanks for inviting me.
And a repeat offender here, Mandy Carvis, a partner at Wickersmith in Phoenix. Thank you for coming out with us.
Yes, good to be here. Guilty as charged.
All right, Rich. President Trump wants to make English the official language of the United States. This is how we're kicking off Trump Watch today.
Well, speaking of that, we forgot we didn't quite get, because we were had so much great content with our first guest, we didn't get in his quote where he called the new number two of the FBI an unqualified, unprincipled partisan henchman. I love that. I love the term henchman whenever I can, because it reminds me of Batman. Remember Batman, the original series, would have all these guys with stripes? To be a henchman, you gotta wear a shirt with stripes, I find.
What? Does it also require a hat of some sort?
A hat is good for a henchman, but yeah, I want to try to bring back the word henchman. Anyway, the other day, Tina, Trump signed another executive order. By the way, like, you know, everything is an executive order. We just heard from another one of our experts that you can't just make law. That's Congress, right? If you're the president, you can't just make law by signing this document, but Trump doesn't care. One of the ones that caught our attention was this order saying that our nation's historic governing documents, including the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, have all been written in English. Therefore, English should be the official language of the United States beginning on March 1st. Again, you know, Trump quoting the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, we know how enamored he is and what an expert he is of jurisprudence and constitutional precedents. And, you know, I'm saying that very tongue in cheek, but do we need English to be the official language? Isn't it already the majority language in this country, Tina? And isn't it an affront to those of our fellow citizens who don't speak English to make it the official language? It's just another sort of, you know, dog whistle, I think, to attacking immigrants, it sounds like. What do you think?
Yeah, it's just another brick in the wall. We're talking about Roger Waters later, so I felt like I had to throw that out. I was waiting for Ryan to do it, but he didn't rise to the challenge. No, Rich, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think against the backdrop of everything else that's changed since January 20th, some would say that this may actually be among the more innocuous is not really the right word, but not as disrupting as some of the other things that are happening in the country. But I agree with you. I mean, I don't think there really is any need to make English be, you know, the official language, but it's part of a bigger story that's going on and that we got more visibility into last night with all the things that our president mentioned during his address. So, I mean, there you have it.
Well, Mandy, a really interesting, you know, legal takeaway from this is really there's really two ways for an executive order to have effect. Either it derives from a federal statute. In this case, he quotes the Declaration and Constitution, neither of which makes English an official language or any other language. The second way an executive order has any power is that it comes from the president's attributed constitutional powers. And, you know, he has the constitutional power to make rules and laws for the federal government as the chief of the executive. But this doesn't, you know, fall within that. You know, we've seen plenty of rules. For example, when he wanted to have one gender only bathrooms, he said that applies to the federal government. You may disagree with that, but it makes sense that as boss of the federal government, he gets to designate the bathrooms. But it doesn't, he doesn't have this constitutional power over the entire country.
Right. I mean, I agree that from a legal standpoint, he doesn't have that authority, but I think
not that any of that matters.
I mean, right. But I think this isn't anything new. We often see new presidents coming in issuing executive orders. And, you know, I'll take the opposite take on this here, which is I'm not really sure why saying that English is the official language of the United States would be any more offensive than France saying that French is the official language of France. I think there's obviously other undertones there. And I don't know that this is necessary, but I don't know that this is really, are we surprised or offended that English is the official language of the United States?
Probably not. Good point. Yeah. Jake, what do you think of this one? And you know, obviously, you know, none of these are getting as much attention as they would if the number of these executive orders were smaller. But there's so many in such a short period of time that the strategy is you can't possibly fight all of these in court. So some of them are going to stick, right?
Yeah. To Mandy's point, I mean, US isn't the only country that has an official language. So making it English, that's fine. I mean, I don't necessarily have a say one way or another. I think the key part of this particular executive order is that he rescinded Bill Clinton's executive order, basically giving the ability to assist non-English speaking individuals at government agencies. So this is going to it wasn't expressly thrown out, but it basically interpreters documents being in other languages to help individuals that do not speak English in the country, basically has the ability to do away with those. So I think that's the key issue here. It's not necessarily making US the official language. It's the rescinding of Bill Clinton's original executive order.
Rich, what's the official language of Canada?
Francais?
Actually, they got two official languages. And hockey, right? That's the third language.
English and French. But, you know, during the midst of all the national anthem booing over the last few weeks with the Four Nations Cup, the female national anthem singer for Canada actually changed the lyrics to the national anthem to make it more anti-Trump, which was pretty unusual.
There you go. All right, moving on. The Cub Scout motto is leave no trace. Rich, it sounds like Jimmy Butler was no Cub Scout when he got traded out of Miami.
Jimmy Butler, much reviled around the NBA for, you know, overstaying his welcome in many cities, even though he's taken massive contracts. We saw him here in Chicago, went to Minnesota, then, you know, had a really successful run with the Heat, took him to the finals, and then just said, I want out of here, even though I'm being paid, $54 million or something. Apparently, he did not leave his landlord very happy. They are seeking, Tina, in a lawsuit, over $250,000, which is a couple months of rent, security deposit, and the cost of damages. They said that he left this 5,400-square-foot rental property, beautiful property in Miami. We all saw the pictures in disarray. You know, he just took off when he was traded to Golden State and didn't keep the pool kept up. You know, it led to algae. Is there a hard G in that word? Algae?
No, it's algae. I know because always I grew up with aquariums. So yeah, had to deal with a lot of algae.
Algae, broken pumps, the HVAC system wasn't kept up, and, you know, they had to come in and repair it. So you would think that with all that money, Jimmy Butler would be able to hire someone to do what we've all done when we've left apartments, like clean it up and leave it in the same way you did. I mean, not that he cares about the security deposit so much, but probably should.
I mean, my guess, Rich, is that, you know, I don't know this guy personally, but, you know, this may go in the bucket of athletes behaving and celebrities behaving badly. He's probably got so much money. He's not even thinking twice about how he leaves this place. I mean, I'm sure that he walked out of there, if he was thinking about it, thinking that he might get sued for the way in which he left it, and just doesn't care. So, I mean, to me, it seemed like it was pretty cut and dry. You know, when you don't do upkeep on things and things break and you're not abiding by the terms of your lease, you know, there's usually provisions about all these sorts of things. I mean, it's probably going to be relatively cut and dry here. And my guess is he's got so much money, it's not an issue for him.
Jason, you've left many an apartment in complete disarray.
I mean, all day, every day. That's just how I roll. But realistically, in this case, I kind of agree with Christina. I mean, we're talking about $257K when his monthly expenses were $130K. I mean, this is literally a drop in the bucket. However, you know, I've been told very many times you never try to count everybody's money or anyone's money for that matter. But I think the thing that was crazy to me is that I've never gone into a rental and changed locks and denied access to maintenance and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that kind of goes like to the far extreme. But you know what? I'm sure he had some great parties there with some pineapple screwdrivers and some other illicit type of fun there. So, I mean, I would imagine $257K for him is probably a drop in the bucket. And it seems like pretty cut and dry.
Moving along, the attorney for Luigi Mangione says his search and Pennsylvania arrest were illegal. Rich, you put this one into the bag for us.
And not surprisingly, Mangione, of course, who is the suspect in the fatal shooting of the United Healthcare CEO outside a New York hotel back in December, his attorney has said that he was not given his Miranda rights. He was not, you know, he was subject to an unconstitutional search and seizure. He is seeking to suppress some of the evidence, Tina. You know, the attorney is doing what he should be doing, and not surprising. On the other hand, I mean, we all saw the video. Of course, the police need to follow constitutional norms of search and seizure. But it seems like an uphill battle for the attorneys here. And I think, as we've discussed on this show before, you know, Mangione walked into a McDonald's and was sitting there eating breakfast in the midst of the largest manhunt in the country. He wasn't exactly hiding. So this idea that he was not treated properly, I'm not sure will hold muster. But even if some of the evidence is thrown out, we have him on video, right, shooting the CEO on the streets of New York. So I don't think it's going to be too successful.
I agree with you, Rich. Hopefully, if you know, these are the cards that his attorneys have to play, right? So they need to play them. The question is, you know, are they going to be successful in getting some of the evidence thrown out? I agree with you. There's a video and we've all seen it. Hopefully we don't have concerns about that getting tossed out of evidence too. I find it hard to imagine, but I think we've all, you know, watched cases over the years enough to know that sometimes unexpected things happen and people who have committed crimes end up getting off because of things like rules of evidence. So I'm sure we'll continue to be talking about this case, whether it's about people sending pictures of themselves into him or how good looking he is or what his attorneys are up to.
Yeah, I mean, Mandy, the attorney says that the police officers who approached him in the McDonald's never told him that he was free to go, never explained why he was being detained. He was being detained because he was a suspect in this murder and because he was recognized because of his, you know, conspicuous eyebrows, among other physical descriptions. I mean, come on, it's a little silly, I think. But what's also troublesome is the amount of attention this guy continues to get. It's only beginning. I mean, this is only the preliminary stages of the evidence. We've heard last week about all of the support he's getting. The GoFundMe page, I think, has raised $500,000 in legal defense fees. You know, he's probably the most celebrated criminal defendant in quite some time, probably since, like, you know, Manson or something like that. It's only going to get worse, and this guy's going to continue to get attention. It's mind-boggling that there's so many people supporting him when he shot this person dead, this father of two dead, on the streets of a major American city.
Yeah, I think it's going to make, obviously, getting a jury pool that doesn't know anything about the case or that doesn't know so much about the case that they can't be fair, to be problematic with all of the stuff that's in the media. Like, is this going to be a change of venue? Is this jury presumably is going to be sequestered, assuming it ever even gets that far? But by the time it gets there, everybody's going to see this guy on TV every time he goes to court for nearly anything. So, you know, and who knows how much of this is PR for him versus how much of this is PR for his counsel, because that certainly occurs too.
Right. Speaking by way of despicable criminal defendants, Ryan, I don't know if you probably saw Casey Anthony's back in the news. She's got she's now a legal expert of some kind. Well, maybe she'll take our job.
There you go. All right, Tina, you already teased this one. A court has found Roger Waters, of Pink Floyd fame, defamed a filmmaker with anti-Semitic comments.
So last week, a London High Court found that the statements that the Pink Floyd co-founder and bassist Roger Waters made accusing a documentary filmmaker of cheerleading the genocide of Palestinians and acting as a Zionist mouthpiece during an Al Jazeera interview are defamatory. These comments were about a filmmaker who had made a documentary about Waters called The Dark Side of Roger Waters, which explored allegations over the years about Waters' alleged anti-Semitism and interviewed a number of people who have known Waters over the course of his career. Waters had made these accusations during this Al Jazeera interview, which led to the producer of the documentary suing him. Last week, the judge concluded that these statements that Waters made were statements of fact and therefore defamatory at common law. What this means is that Waters can't argue that he was expressing his opinions in an effort to try to be avoiding liability for defamation. So this ruling is just an additional preliminary ruling, which now advances the case towards trial. The court explicitly rejected Waters' arguments that his statements were intended to be opinions on the conduct of Israeli forces in Gaza. Waters clearly disagrees. In a post on his website, he says that this documentary has been indiscriminately mixing things that he allegedly said or did at different times in an effort to portray him as an anti-Semite, and that there isn't any foundation in fact, Rich. So, I mean, I think we've all, those of us who are familiar with Roger Waters and Pink Floyd, have heard these allegations over the years that he's anti-Semitic. And it seems like this court is holding him accountable, at least for the defamatory comments that he made.
Well, not just heard the suspicions, but heard his words. I mean, this guy's a disgusting bigot who's been, you know, vocal on these anti-Zionist rants for like over two decades. And no matter how talented you may think he is as an artist, he's an awful person, an awful bigot. And you know, there's a difference between free speech, no matter what country you're in, and, you know, abject anti-Semitism, racism, prejudice. And the more that courts work to shut him up, the more in favor I am of it. So, yeah, good development. Jason, what are your thoughts on it?
I think it's simple. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. So it just seems, in my opinion, this should be open and close. And realistically, there's just been too many allegations out there just to kind of brush it under the rug at this point.
Manny, what are your thoughts on it? Defend anti-Semitism.
Sure, sure.
Come on, Manny.
I'll play the heel today. I'll play the heel today. What about the First Amendment?
There you go.
Aren't you, especially in response to someone doing a documentary about what a shoddy and crappy person you are, shouldn't you be allowed to defend yourself? Or should he sue them for making a documentary defaming him? Where does the line stop between this is my opinion and this is fact? And, you know, what about good old free speech? So,
I mean, it doesn't sound like it's a battle over money. There you go, Tina. I got you right there. All right. It sounds like a big mess in California when a bar licensing exam was improperly run, Tina.
Yeah, Ryan. So, you know, taking the bar is stressful enough. Just imagine not being able to complete it because of technical difficulties. This is what happened a few weeks ago with a proposed class of bar exam takers that took the bar exam in California. They're claiming that the company that was administering California's exam, which is called Measure Learning, failed spectacularly, as they called it, in running the exam by having software that simply didn't work, and claiming that they had been fielding reports of technical glitches and customer service issues for weeks leading up until the exam. And they also claimed that this company falsely claimed that some of those issues had been resolved before the exam. Test takers say that as a result, the online testing windows as they were taking the exam were crashing, that their essays failed to save, and that they couldn't copy and paste text. The plaintiffs claimed they were traumatized and that they've had their career ambitions delayed. And that they had paid for what was software that was rushed and fast-tracked and wasn't ready to accommodate the huge number of people who were taking the exam. They also claimed that the defendants offered to waive fees for them to retake the exam in July is simply inadequate. And Rich, it's looking like their damages claim could exceed $5 million here. So this is interesting. It's something that we didn't have to deal with when we took the bar exam because we're old fogies.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's only the first complaint. There will be many more. I mean, you know, I usually am the one who describes any kind of emotional distress or pain and suffering claim in this circumstance as BS. But, you know, it's really traumatizing to prepare for the bar to take it. It's one I can't imagine for those of us that have taken it, a more difficult, stressful thing in your life. Really, it's in the top three for sure. And then for this all to happen, I think there is a legitimate claim that you're traumatized. It has an effect on your life, certainly on your career. So, yeah, I think they're going to have to write a check here, and there's more lawsuits to come. Mandy, this would have been very difficult to go through, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, that's why I'm glad that I was in the handwriting days of the bar exam. I mean, I even remember that the back then the bar exam that flipped between Tucson and Phoenix, and we were in Tucson that time, and we were inside the convention center, and there were birds like flying around inside that somehow got trapped in there, and a guy like passed out and was laying on the floor, and paramedics came in, and I remember making like mental notes to myself, distracting test environment, you know, just in case things were bad. But man, this, you're not even being able to save your work or send your work. I can't even imagine. And now they're going to have to wait until presumably July to take the bar exam again. So a lot of their compensation is probably tied to them passing the bar and becoming a licensed attorney. So, and I can't imagine a more terrifying group of plaintiffs, a bunch of lawyers to be.
Now, Jason, you deal with claims all the time. What would you do if you were faced with these claims?
Get out in front of it as quickly as possible, because they're going to pay out one way or another. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind. But from what I've heard and what I've read thus far, it seems like this makes complete and utter sense that they're going to pay out something. I think that number is going to be well over $5 million. Because you got to think about the pain and suffering. What about if potential future earnings, if an individual can no longer pass that particular bar exam because of the trauma that they originally endured during their first test taking? So I think this is, we have not heard the last, but I think $5 million is a scratch on the surface.
All right, back to sports. Famed NFL kicker Justin Tucker is denying allegations of sexual assault, but Rich, he's also apologizing.
Yeah, you know, and not just what struck me, Ryan and Tina, about the apology is it's so typical and it's so dumb that people don't learn, right? It's like basic public relations. These apologies always follow the same pattern. And it's this. It's, if I offended anyone by my actions, I am sorry. Guess what? You offended someone. There's not a question about whether you offended. So it's this like sly, winky, weak way of saying, you know, I didn't do anything wrong, but if you, the victim, misinterpreted my appropriate reactions, it's really on you, but I'm going to say I'm sorry. I mean, that's ridiculous. I get it. Like, you can't admit, you know, he doesn't want to admit liability, he's denying it, but it's like, aren't we over that idea already? Haven't we seen this movie so many times that if I'm offended, and by the way, it's not one person, it's not two people, it's not three people, it's 16 separate massage therapists, right? We saw this happen with, what's his name? Deshaun Watson, soon to be former Cleveland Browns quarterback, you know, with multiple women. And he says, Tina, that is simply not true. He said, anyone I've worked with over the years would back me up. Well, apparently these 16 separate people don't back him up. You know, the Ravens are probably going to release him. He had an awful season on the field this past season. John Harbaugh's coach said, we love him, but we're going to look at his, you know, status. We're going to let the NFL investigation play out, but I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's a pretty damaging allegations.
Hey, Rich, and I completely agree with you about this whole notion of these apologies that are not really apologies. I would strongly recommend that folks who are in this position and dealing with their PR folks, you know, in these types of situations, give some serious thought about whether they're doing anything helpful to their cause by giving apologies like this. I understand that there are concerns about even intimating, especially when you're denying culpability, doing anything or saying anything that could be used against you. That being said, don't even bother with an apology if you're going to make an apology like this. I don't think it helps at all. If anything, it makes you even more of a PR disaster, and it just doesn't help your cause at all.
Speaking of PR disasters, I mean, Mandy, again, I mentioned John Harbaugh, a very successful coach, one of the longest serving coaches, if not the longest right now with one team in the NFL, said, Justin's our kicker. We love him. I always expected him to keep going forever, but nobody goes forever. I mean, I appreciate the loyalty, you know, but, you know, in the wake of all of these NFL scandals over the years, beginning with Ray Rice and, you know, culminating with some of the other allegations recently, it seems a little tone deaf.
Yes, but I do think, again, I'm being the heel all day, and so I'll keep it going. And as someone who defends cases of this kind of nature, kind of all around the country, I think it's important for, with this one in particular, that these are just allegations, and he has the right to defend himself against those allegations. And obviously, the NFL isn't presumably going to suspend or get rid of somebody just based on allegations because of legal implications there as well. And we are talking about allegations from back in 2012 through 2016, so 10 plus years ago. Obviously, I think if you behaved badly that long ago, you would recall that. But the fact that they are so remote, I think the NFL would probably be hard-pressed to let him go. Now, to let him go for the games that he blew this year for missing kicks, sure. You know, his stats were not good, but, you know, it may be a convenient out for them to say, we're going to move on because of your statistics. Unfortunately, they didn't help him this year.
Jason, he deserves his day in court, to Manny's point, but we know that the NFL is in court. They have their own standards, their own investigation, and they could suspend him or, you know, take other action regardless of whether he's criminally liable or even civilly liable.
Yeah. I mean, NFL has their own sets of rules, as you mentioned. So I think that when you have 16 individuals coming forward, it just kind of, we need to hear them. We need to hear what they have to say, because, and maybe I think too much about all the sexual abuse claims that I see in amateur sports today, and then seeing it at a professional level and a professional athlete. I mean, they deserve their voices to be heard. So I think that we should definitely hear them out on it. But as Mandy said, they are allegations at this point. So let's just bring it to light. Very similar to, if we're going to say, like a Larry Nassar case, let's just bring all the information to light and let's see what shakes out. As far as my personal feeling, Justin Tucker was in my fantasy this year, 73.3 field goal percentage. Just kick him out now.
Kickers matter, right?
Kickers matter. I pick them up early, especially if it's Tucker.
All right. We've got an airport rage story out of Miami. Tina, we always have rage when we're at the airport, but certainly we don't act on it.
Yeah. Most well, maybe you and I don't, Ryan, but I think unfortunately there are more and more people who do, like our Brazilian couple out of the Miami International Airport this past weekend that was arrested for battery, resisting arrest, and trespassing after they became irate over missing a flight. Apparently, there are allegations that they ignored no trespassing signs on the jet bridge that would have gotten them from Miami to Cancun, where they were going to celebrate their recent wedding engagement. There were allegations that they threw coffee at two people in frustration. And the couple claimed that because they were denied access to the plane, they missed their connection. So the couple denies throwing coffee. If you watch the videos, they're very animated in their denial of the throwing of the coffee. They say it fell by accident, and that the person who's accusing them of throwing the coffee is a liar. The man of the couple claims that he got scraped up by authorities when he was pulled down to the floor after he resisted arrest, or so the police claim. American Airlines and passengers who were nearby don't necessarily agree with this version of the story. The airline released a statement, Rich, that acts of violence are not tolerated on their airlines and that they're committed to closely working with law enforcement in the investigation. It was an interesting set of videos, if you all had a chance to watch them.
I go back and forth with the story. I mean, you know, listen, who among us hasn't wanted to throw something at someone at the airport? So control yourself. You know, I don't really buy their statement that, no, I'm not crazy. Coffee, we don't want to throw coffee. Coffee I drink. But let's get right to our question here and go around the horn. And Jason, tell us your something that would happen during your travels, either at the airport, in the airplane, or somewhere else, that would cause you to throw hot coffee at someone. God knows the amount we travel. There's always some nonsense going on. I got a laundry list of things, but what's the last thing that caused you to want to throw coffee at someone in your travels?
I think it's the biggest thing for me is if I happen to be unlucky enough, and it happens sometimes, you just need to hop on a plane. You're in that middle seat, and individuals might need two seats. That might be a cause when I'm kind of like sitting there. Like, I feel like I'm a small guy to begin with, but if I'm sitting there like this, that might actually get me. But I like my coffee, so I mean, and I'm also like I'm not a fighter.
Not cheap.
So I just gladly sit there in my small seat and drink my coffee.
Not cheap to throw like a $9 venti at someone.
Maggie, exactly.
What's the latest scrape?
The latest is actually my husband and I went to Cabo for Thanksgiving, and we were flying back. We were sitting on the plane. They had closed the door. We were all ready to go. And then they said, oh, you know what? Another plane has a sick flight attendant. We happen to have a vacationing flight attendant on our flight who's willing to work. So we're going to send our clocked in flight attendant over to the other flight so they can also take off. Well, guess who sat on the runway for 2.5 hours while we waited to get the new vacationing flight attendant's paperwork downloaded?
That's happening more than ever. It's mind-boggling how they can't figure out how an entire plane full of people are dependent on whether someone is making this airplane because they're on vacation, for Christ's sake. It's absolutely unnerving. Tina, what's your pet peeve of the airport?
My worst experience recently, I mean, everything that Jason and Mandy mentioned, you know, there's been similar, you know, I think we've all experienced that. I was on a flight to New York. We were landing at LaGuardia. We were about 5 minutes from landing. It was one unfortunate day that I was put in a window seat rather than an aisle seat. I'm an aisle person for a whole host of reasons, including liking to make a quick escape. While there were no quick escapes being made when the young girl sitting in the middle seat next to me got violently ill because of the turbulence flying into LaGuardia. So yeah, that was, her father was mortified. He was a daddy-daughter weekend in New York, and it was a pretty messy situation.
Quick Not escape, just ill, what are you, violent, you stealing Ill. Stuff from people? Why do you need a quick escape?
Just because either if I need a bio break or just, you know, for whatever reason, I like to have optionality, Ryan. Let's just leave it at that.
Ryan,
short
one.
I got raged on by this little like 4'8" woman for United Airlines in Munich. My wife and I did not show up in the 2 hours prior to boarding, and she let us know about it and asked us many times why we did not show up on time. We ended up missing our flight, and we had to catch the next one. She took our passports away, walked away with them, and we didn't see him for about 30 minutes until she brought him back and said, I've got you new tickets. So we had no idea what she was doing with our passports. Just took them and walked away.
Wow. Well, I got a lot. I travel a lot. I got a lot, man. One of mine is when the TSA agent asks you a question that they only found out because they watch Cops. You know, they grab your bag and they ask you this question. They say, is there anything in there that would stick me? Yeah, you know, I'm traveling with a javelin in my bag. That's going to stick you. I also love when you're in that exit row, right? And they ask you this question. They say, the flight attendant comes down and she says, listen up, I need a verbal response. Are you ready, willing, and able to help in the event of an emergency? Let me get this straight. I paid an extra $30 for legroom, and I have to be both ready, willing, and able? I got to pass a 3-part test? If we're going down to the Atlantic, I'm not helping anyone. There's no way I'm helping the guy sitting next to me. So, and what if you're just ready and willing but not able? Suddenly, I got to be a Navy SEAL on this Spirit Airline to Vegas. It's a little much, I find. So I got a lot of those.
Dude, does Lisa got one?
Lisa, you got any?
My
Do they have planes in Indiana? Or is there an airport in the state of Indiana?
Yeah, Indianapolis. And Gary, by the way. I hate it when you're departing the plane and people rush the aisle so you can't get your luggage off of the overhead baggage claim, like the overhead baggage. Like, where are you going? We're all in one single line.
Uh-oh, oh, yeah. The people who are
coming for you.
Yeah, the lunatics who are saying, excuse me, I got to get by. What do you mean you got to get by? It's a fucking airplane.
Yes.
You can't walk by me. We're all getting out the same. There's one exit. Maniacs.
All of a sudden, yeah, everyone's got a connecting flight, right?
Yeah,
that's the George Costanza exit.
Yeah. Or Tina, who just swiped something from someone. All right, well, that'll do it. Thank you so much, Mandy Carvis and Jason DeMarco. By the way, on your way out, please don't Jimmy Butler the place. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Aaron Murphy, a Norman Dorson professor of civil liberties at NYU, Elizabeth Semmel, a Chancellor's Clinical Professor of Law and co-director of the Death Penalty Clinic at UC Berkeley, Greg Nunziata, Executive Director of the Society for the Rule of Law. Also shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkov, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...